to Screen Tone Club, episode 27. This is being recorded on the 24th of June 2019 for release on the 25th of June 2019. You may have noticed some tweets from us about how we were supposed to be recording it yesterday due to my equipment and Windows deciding to team up to try and destroy the podcast. But we have prevailed, thank goodness. Joining me, Elliot Page, as always, is my lovely, lovely co-host, Mr. Andy Hanley. How are you doing, Andy?
Yeah, I'm doing very well. I'm looking forward to us being the only two people on the internet here not to talk about Evangelion, so that'll be nice.
I'm afraid I might be fixing or breaking that when it comes to the end of this episode. But hey, that's a preview. First and foremost, this is our fortnightly look at manga with a focus on joint discussion between me and Andy here. We'll be announcing our series ahead of time so you can read them if you fancy. Or if you're like Demel's Award, friend of the show, you can just buy the series before we get to talk about them, thus negating our need as reviewers. But we're not here to review, we're here to discuss, dissect, critique, etc., etc. If you like this show, thank you. But also you can support us on Patreon, and I heartily encourage you to do so. It keeps the lights on, and also if you chuck us $1 a month, you get bonus episodes every month. And if you chuck us a little more money, you get to vote on what we then have to cover. And on that note, we have come down to the line for this month's episode, bonus episode voting, and we have another tie. So I have here in another tab random.org. So here we go. And the winner is Land of the Lustrous. So next, our bonus episode is going to be on Land of the Lustrous, Volume 1. I'll probably use this as an excuse to reread the entire thing again because I like that show already, that series already. So thank you everyone for balancing out the light novels, although the light novels weren't that bad. So yeah, Land of the Lustrous. Have you read it before, Andy?
Yes, yeah. I'm not kind of fully up to date with it. I've read like the first 4 volumes, I think, at this point. So yeah, like it's one of those series where it's always on my like, oh, I should completely catch up with this list, and then for some reason it always falls by the wayside.
Okay, cool. Well, we'll see how far we get individually, and we can talk about it in general on that bonus episode, which will be out in about a week from the time of the release. Also, quick note, also on our Patreon is the shout outs tier, and this means we get to shout you out on this show. So shout outs to Rob Jessup, who has very kindly been supporting us at a silly level for far too long. But again, thank you ever so much, Rob. Right, moving on to the main bulk of the show, we have Returning Champions, a section where we discuss series we have already talked about at one point or another in the show, and we want to get back to. Andy, you put an item on this document that I am hilariously behind on, but I am devastatingly interested to hear what you think about the continuation of Dead Dead Demons DDDD Destruction, Volume 5.
Yes, right. I'm glad you said that so that I didn't have to, because I always miss out a de in there somewhere. Following on from Volume 4 of this series, I was really expecting Dead Dead Demon to kind of just like put the pedal to the metal, put the hammer down, and really kind of just go all in on the direction it seemed to have set itself on. So I buckled myself in thinking, okay, this is really going to go places. But actually, ironically, this volume kind of does the opposite, and it's almost a bit of a sort of freeze frame of sorts on kind of where things have been headed in that series. And to start with, there was a moment where I was always a little bit disappointed of like, I kind of wanted to see, you know, what your kind of moves towards the end game of the series might be. But actually, it does some really good things, because A, it kind of lets it dig a little more deeply into the kind of the whole culture war that effectively the series has set up over its volumes. So, you know, there is effectively kind of almost what feels like a side story kind of chapter or so that kind of joins this guy who's a member of the army that is fighting against these kind of alien invaders that are hanging around Tokyo. And it kind of shows like the various kind of struggles around him. Like, he has a sister who's very much on the kind of side of the sort of, you know, pacifism and like, you know, not just killing all these aliens. Like, his family are very proud that he's, you know, in the army and that, you know, he's fighting and he's a veteran. And he's kind of in this weird sort of middle ground where, A, obviously he has a job and employment, which is good for him. But he's also very kind of torn on the actual nature of what he's doing and kind of what it means in the grand scheme of things. And it's just this really good little kind of like picture portrait of I think we can probably all relate to, especially in 2019, of this whole thing where kind of like families have been kind of like pulled apart on a kind of political level because of events going on where, you know, you have different generations that have very different kind of priorities and very different takes on the kind of things going on in the world. And it's just a really good kind of direct portrait of that, just taken through this one single family. And it doesn't outstay its welcome. It doesn't kind of, it doesn't become overbearing. It doesn't really, you know, have an angle that it really wants to push. It's just a very kind of simple, like, yeah, this is kind of what life is like for a lot of people within the kind of the context of this series, where, you know, there are these very kind of different sides that have kind of built up around this singular event, and is kind of like inescapable that people who were perhaps once friends or kind of close family have effectively kind of come to blows or fallen out over this because of, you know, what it means and how invested and engaged everybody is in it. So that's kind of one angle that it tackles really well. And the other interesting part is that this volume kind of takes some time out to really kind of dig into Kodode and Ontan's relationship, which is kind of, yeah, it's like it's the defining thing of this series, and, you know, it's kind of the thing that guides everything that happens, certainly in the early volumes before it kind of, you know, has more offshoots. But this kind of, it digs into it in various ways. There's kind of a little bit of sort of flashback to, you know, sort of how they first met and how they first fell in as friends, which is kind of somewhat predictable. It's probably the kind of thing you might expect from what you learn about those characters, but, you know, it's still kind of an interesting, it's interesting to see that kind of played out and explicitly sort of, you know, committed to the page. But it also kind of does some good sort of digging into those two characters and their current state of play, because clearly the two of them are very close. They kind of, you know, they rely on one another for a lot of things, and it kind of explores both the positives of that and, you know, kind of what those two characters do for one another on a daily basis in both kind of practical and emotional terms. But it also kind of digs into the counterpoints to that, and the fact that, you know, both of these characters to a certain extent are also kind of hamstrung by their friendship. Like, they're both over-reliant on one another for certain things as kind of like, you know, an anchor for each other. And there's some really good moments that are kind of quite subtle, but very kind of very well defined in terms of Ontan in particular, kind of who's, it really digs in beyond just the kind of the basic kind of like, you know, she's just kind of loud and exuberant and clearly kind of covering up her anxieties by just being, you know, the center of attention. Like, it kind of, it digs in some really interesting ways into kind of what lies underneath that, and kind of, and you kind of get to see that a lot of kind of what she actually wants from life is kind of almost just held back by the people around her, because she's painted herself into a corner in a certain sense.
Oh yeah, at that point you don't, especially with a character like Ontan, you don't get a reset button, especially as a teenager. Like, until you like do something major, like change schools or move away to university or college or a job, you're stuck because you can't reset all that. You know, every single day is important in your school life because you're constantly socially connected, and there's no way to unfix any of that. You're kind of stuck there.
Yeah. And it's kind of the irony of these two characters at this point, where they've had opportunities where they could have gone their own ways, you know, at least in terms of, you know, their education and kind of, you know, what they do on the day to day, but they chose to kind of stick together. And it kind of, you know, it shows the negative impact of that. And, you know, it's kind of, it's starting to have an emotional impact on those characters because they've become so over-reliant on one another. But yeah, like, it's really, it's kind of one of the things I wanted to see that series do. So it's really good to see it do that and do it well. And as per always with this series, I'm kind of really curious to see where it goes next and whether we're going to kind of continue with this kind of something of a pausing in terms of kind of the bigger picture events to kind of continue to focus on this stuff, or whether it's going to kind of start, you know, barreling forward again. Because it certainly, it also sets up some things in this volume that are very much a case of like, okay, well, somebody could press the play button on this at any moment now and kind of really start moving things forward, and it would totally make sense. But at the same time, there's also so much fascinating character stuff going on here that I'd be quite happy if we kind of, you know, freeze frame on this for a little while.
Yeah, I feel like the concept of freeze framing on a certain point and just spinning out stories from that is something I've dearly wished for quite a few series. Because it's like you get to a point where it's like, oh man, I love the whole suite of characters. Can we not advance the plot line and just kind of enjoy this and, you know, do the whole side story slash guide end style thing, and then no, sorry, we have to keep the plot moving because we haven't found a way to pause it, so we're just going to carry on and bundle past some characters sort of thing, which, you know, happens a lot in a lot of series, frankly. But yeah, it's nice that it gets time to do that. And also, like, I'm only up to volume 3 of this myself, and the flash is a flash forward at one point, which is really ominous in a really passive, like sort of mundane way about Ontan and Kodode. And it's just like, oh, okay, there's a lot to unpack here. And so it sounds like the series is now kind of through a combination of flashback and also development, they're able to both like preload and also unpack a lot of that, which sounds fascinating. Like a lot of the characters about it and are really fascinating. And also, like you say, like, it's a really smart move to be able to pause the action as such as it is, because even to being 2 volumes behind, I feel like the core world state slash plot of the world of Dead Dead Demons, you could basically resolve in 3 chapters if you really wanted to. Like the core, you know, aliens hanging in the sky, like cultural warfare thing could be resolved very easily. And also in a vaguely satisfying manner. So it's like, oh, you know, taking time to pause this is a smart move because you're not having to constantly lay more road in front of you. I mean, hell, yeah. Like recent Shonen Jump finishing series Food Wars kept, like, the only way it could, the only medium it could play in was tournaments. And then it went one tournament too far and everyone got sick of it because it wanted to have more stories to tell about its characters, but it ran out of road in places to show it. So, whoops.
Yeah. So yeah, it's definitely, you know, if you've been on board with that series at all, it's still well worth sticking with. It still looks amazing, like visually, like I just love the art style. And so yeah, like I mean, I think it's gone on hiatus again in Japan, so I guess it may be a while before we see more of it at this point. But I'm definitely on board for it whenever it deems to return to my e-reader.
Yeah, I've got, as I say, I'm 2 volumes behind, so I think I'll just draw those out a wee smidge so I don't get slamming into withdrawal. Whoops. Cool. No, that's great. That's now I just want to load up my tablet right now and read it. thankfully, it's not in arm's reach. So moving on, I have another Attending Champion, which is volume 2 of Oh Maidens in Your Savage Season, the series written by Mario Kada, which we talked about in a previous episode. And volume 2 is a bit of a weird duck, quite frankly. It somehow has a slower pace than volume 1. There's a much more well-defined sort of like overplot line, and you have more of the characters being filled out. But as a result, it's somewhat slower because it has to balance its time between this A plot, the overplot, and also just the different characters and their deals. And there are multiple characters who haven't really had their, you know, their guts spilled as of yet. You have quite a lot about the main character, who I can't remember the name of again, and Izumi, her boy childhood friend, next door neighbor slash person she walked in on wanking, and that continues to befuddle her, and she keeps doing dumb shit that is really just exhausting everyone involved. There's some really fun, interesting bits where basically, like, the main character is trying to talk to her parents about her own conception, basically, and her parents just turn into full nostalgia. Oh, when you're a baby and you were 12 hours in labor and all this sort of stuff, like, which, you know, I don't know, maybe it's just my family, but I've heard that shit like 16 times after dinner. But we're not yet, we've eaten dinner, we haven't digested enough to do the dishes or get pudding, and so we're just going to talk about dumb shit like old sweets and places we used to live. It's, you know, dumb family conversations, and that always comes up because my parents love to make me embarrassed, I guess. But yeah, as I say, it's got a lot of interesting threads. You've got the little girl who you got the character who is like cyber chatting with someone and trying to write a novel, which is kind of spinning out in her own directions. And as I say, it's slower overall, but it's certainly very, very fun to read. And I love all the characters dearly. At this point, almost, I feel like there's almost too much Like, it's kind of an embarrassment of riches at this point, because I love all the individual characters and their storylines, but there's now, like, four individual storylines going on. And so it's a case of, I read the volume and went, oh, that seemed quite slight. And it's like, well, no, it's not. A lot happened. But it's just spread out amongst these four different, like, tracks. And so it feels like I'm getting a little bit of movement in multiple places, which doesn't, it kind of confuses you when it comes to how much has gotten done. So, but yeah, it's a very good read, still looks very pretty. Some real funny sort of like teenage flying off the handle sort of stuff. So yeah, it's a good read still. I definitely recommend it. It's really annoying me now that I can't remember the bloody main character's name. you think I'd get better at this, wouldn't you?
But yeah, I mean, I'm definitely, I was kind of in, part of me was thinking I might try and like read volume two before this podcast, but like it's definitely a series that I just kind of want to take a bit of time to luxuriate in, given how much I enjoyed volume one. So it's like, you know, I'll wait until I have like a good time that I can really, really read through it. But I'm definitely looking forward to checking out that second volume.
Yeah. In my case, I just sort of found out through the grapevine that volume two was out, and I was like, oh, okay. And I just caught up. So I had enough like points in my Bookwalker account, so I bought it for quote unquote free using those. So hooray, they have me. Like, they have me in their stupid bloody point system. Blech. But yeah, so moving on to the actual bulk of today's show. So do you want to go first or shall I, Andy?
Given that both of our picks are from the same author, I feel like we should go kind of chronologically in terms of like releases, so you should probably go first on this one.
Okay, fair enough. I think it's actually the other way around. Well, it's in terms of English releases, but I think they were written one before the other. Okay, either way, whatever. So we have a double bill from Akiko Higashimura, her of Princess Jellyfish fame, who I feel like is having her spot in the sun, at least in English translated manga. Like belated enjoyment of Princess Jellyfish. She was highlighted at the British Museum show with quite a few sort of like shout outs and bits with her like front and center. And so I have gone back to the Kodansha released digital first title Tokyo Terra River Girls, with volume one. It's currently all available digitally, all nine volumes of it, and I think it's on volume three-ish physically, if you're buying it physically. It is complete digital, not quite physical, so there we are. So I picked it up digital and read it I started reading it like 2 years ago and then kept up with the releases as they came out. So Tokyo Terra River Girls charts a trio of sort of early 30s, creeping towards mid 30s women, who all are single. They all kind of, the series opens with the rather dire sort of mention of, oh, one day I woke up, I was 33 and I was still single. And it's kind of like, woof, like hell of a page one. And it basically involves these characters at a time when Japan actually won the right to host the 2020 Olympic Games. It opens on that concept of, oh, crap, if I'm still single when 2020 rolls around, I'm going to be 40. Shit. And, you know, Japan has an awful lot of pressure around marriage, especially for women and such. And I'm not going to really litigate that whole thing because there's much better resources on it on the internet. But basically, these women are starting to feel the, like, as it plays out in the series, they have up until now basically been quite happy to exist in happy singledom. And now things are starting to barrel down on them, either internally or externally facing, that are making them start to, frankly, panic a little and want to get hitched. For various reasons, either for personal security, personal justification, or just the general feeling of gnawing, pitiless loneliness. And okay, I'm gonna look at my notes now because I definitely want to know the characters' names, god damn it. I'm not gonna get outdone this time. I'm gonna edit this out. I can't fucking find it. Sorry, Andy.
Sorry.
If you remember, please say.
I know the main character is Rinko, but I can't remember any of the other characters' names.
Yes. So, yeah, Rinko is the main character. She is a screenwriter, and she is, you know, moderately independent, moderately successful, has her own business, is a freelance screenwriter, has her own apartment, which she kind of shares with her office mate. And through that, kind of just always quite happily milling around, it kind of goes back in time when to this date she went on 10 years ago with a guy who she kind of blew out of the water. And as the series kind of gets going and ramps up, she thinks she sort of takes a second look at him and goes, oh, well, he definitely, you know, he grew up well. You know, he's not the scrawny, like, young 20s dude with no worldliness about him. And then she gets all dressed up to the nines, goes on a date with him, and he basically says, hey, what do you think of this ring? I'm thinking of asking out your coworker, and her world kind of ends right there and then. And she then defaults to what is basically these girls' standby of getting screamingly drunk in Koyuki, one of her friends, Ryokan, her pub, which sounds like a good old merry time. And through that, they managed to piss off another local, another regular of the pub, who is this like frighteningly attractive boy, sort of young man. And it turns out that in a twist of fate, he is a famous model who is starting to break into, you know, modeling and more acting and such, and manages to get tapped to work on one of Akiko's screenplays. And things kind of just get more messy and confused. This first volume, the series as a whole, focuses on all three of the main characters, who I love dearly. There's Koyuki, who works in the ryokan, and she's the one with glasses, who's quite tall with dark hair. And there's the other one who owns a nail salon, who I cannot remember the name of, and I'm not looking that one up. And Akiko, and all three of them are kind of accessing this from different point of view, and all of them are kind of having their world rocked as they try and come to terms with the fact that, yo, we're 33, most of our friends already got married, and we kind of sat on the sidelines and mocked them for one reason or another, and now we're still saying to ourselves, whatever, we can get back into the game whenever we want, and finding that, yo, it's way harder than that. It's way, way harder than that. And also, maybe, well, you're not as happy as you thought you were. Maybe you won't get your happy ending. Maybe you're stuck. As the name of the title goes, Terra Reba, which is basically a way of saying what if. A Terra Reba, in this case, you've got Terra and Reba, which is basically like liver and milt, which are a pair of bar snacks which they commonly eat at the ryokan. And of course, as you get drunk, they come to life and start mocking you and saying you're forever going to be alone, which is great for your own bar snacks to mock you mercilessly like that. I feel like I've gone all over the shop with this, because I do love this show, this series dearly, but it kind of, it taps an awful lot for me. Like, I read it 2 years ago, and even then it kind of hit me quite hard when I was the young age of 31, and now I'm 33, the age of the characters in this series. And I'm like, yeah, this is even more the case. And like, I've talked to people who were going through this exact thing and are female and women themselves, and, you know, went through everything and more that's in this series, and were like, yeah, this is legit, which is kind of scary about it, where it hits all of it so hard. And the reason why I'm kind of going over the place is because it's kind of a big mess of emotions in this series, and it knows how to slip between, you know, reality and subjective internal space of the characters as they're trying to work out what's happening to them, and their emotions take over, like feeling that the world is collapsing beneath you. You know, your bar snacks are coming to life and talking to you all the time. At the same time, your dad won't stop yelling at you, and your stupid younger sort of trainee / protege is probably going to steal your job at any minute, and oh god, what am I doing? Was this not what I wanted? So it's kind of a whole big bundle of all that sort of stuff, all tied up in a very tense but also very human bow. Like, it does the whole thing where Akiko in particular, like, gets really full of herself and then eats shit, and you feel bad for her, but at the same time, it's your own damn fault, lass. Like, you really set yourself up to be kicked in the head there, which is what makes the makes the events of it kind of a lot more amusing rather than just disheartening. Is that, you know, you can see the character's thought patterns and you go, yes, I can see why you'd think that. You're probably wrong. And then they eat shit, and you're like, well, yeah, we could see this coming, couldn't we, both of us? Sorry, I've gone all over the shop, as I've said three times already. So I just want to ask Andy, can you anchor me? What did you think about this?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's a series where it's kind of, as you mentioned, by its very nature, you kind of end up going all over the place talking about it, because so often kind of series like this have one very singular focus, like whether it's a romantic angle, whether it's a workplace angle, whatever it is, it tends to have, you know, maybe there'll be the odd kind of like side plot that comes in, but there's normally a very kind of a very close and central focus.
A critical path, one would say.
Yeah, exactly. And like, I think one of the things that is really enjoyable about this series that the first volume does a really good job of showing in particular is it's very good at just depicting life in a broader sense. Like, you know, if just because you're having a rough time, like, with your love life, like, that doesn't mean that you're not still going to work and having, like, issues to deal with there, or vice versa. Like, if you're at work, that doesn't mean that, you know, you just press the pause button on any romantic interests, etc., etc. Like, and I think that's one of the things that this series juggles really well, is, like, you know, Rinko in particular, like, she's got stuff going on at work, which is, you know, stressful for her. She also has stuff going on in her personal life, and it's, like, it's not a one or the other. Like, this is just life. This is, like, everyday stuff where you can end up in a place where, you know, you've got stuff you need to deal with during the day, and then, you know, you go home in the evening and you've got stuff to worry about there as well. And like, I think it does a really good job of kind of keeping all of those balls in the air and kind of juggling them well in a way that is very relatable. I think, you know, it's not just a case of this is my singular problem that I have to fix this week. It's like, ah, I've got this stuff going on here and I've got this stuff going on here, and, you know, sometimes all of those things pile up to the point where you need to get blind drunk with your friends in a pub. And, you know, I think it relays all of that really, really well. I think it's also a really good series in terms of kind of the friendship between those three main characters is just really well played. Like, I think especially once you get into your 30s, like, A, you end up with, rather than having like a huge group of friends, you tend to end up with a small number of really close friends who you can talk about anything with. And, you know, you get to that point, much like the characters here, where you just have a bunch of in-jokes or things that you can just reference, and everyone else around the table will know what you mean, even though like a complete stranger would be like, what the heck are they talking about? And that's one of the other angles I really like about this series, is like the main three characters, you know, they have their own little phrases and in jokes. It's like, you know, when they need to get together for a drink, they have like a fire alarm system from like, you know, one alarm to four alarm, depending on like what the problem is and how severe it is. And, you know, when they meet each other, they're constantly like, oh yeah, you remember that time you really screwed this up? And it's like, you know, it's that very familiar, very comfortable friendship where you can, you know, the boundaries of how you can, you know, rag on the other people and, you know, borderline insult them without going too far. And, you know, you just have all these little kind of these bits and these moments. And some of my favorite things I think about this series are just the way those three characters bounce off of one another. Like, it's very much, you know, even as a guy, like, it's very relatable that, like, oh yeah, you know, you have a group of friends that you kind of have that kind of relationship with. And I think even before you kind of get into the nitty-gritty of kind of like the romance angle and the personal life angle of this series, like, it just really gets it right on those kind of fundamental levels.
Yeah, totally. Like, just the ability to interrelate with like friends you're very closely knitted with, and also sometimes how that can be a problem where it ends up either being a echo chamber or an anti-echo chamber where it's like, oh, should I do this? No! I was like, oh, shit, maybe I should have. But equally, as you say, like, the interrelation of all the stuff that happens in your life, like, you know, in the case of Rinko, like, you know, her love life starts affecting her work life, which then affects her personal life, which then loops back around to her work life, to her romance again, and everything, it's not like it's all subordinated to one single track, as you said earlier, but it is the fact where it's like everything, nothing's going to stop pinballing around. Like, you can't just fix one thing at a time because shit's flying everywhere, especially with what happens. And one thing, last thing about this volume, one extra thing about this plotting of this volume is it ends on a real good sort of last page banger of a, like, here's the setup done, and now the rest of the series is going to happen. Like, it doesn't, like, draw a line under it, but it's more the fact of, like, okay, we've done the setup, and now shit's going to get wild, because we've ended this on a real nutty note, which is a real smart way of ending it, because it kind of, it brings around the initial sort of, like, struggle of the setup, and Akiko trying to find and sort of plant her flag, and then it turns into, like, oh, shit, like, this is it now, like, we're into the real shit.
Yeah, and it also, like...
Oh, sorry, Rinko, not Akiko, I read the author's name. Shit, it's Rinko, sorry. Oh.
Yes, indeed. And I mean, the kind of the irony of the ending of this first volume as well is that it's... And this is one of the things that I kind of find myself thinking about in terms of just reading this first volume versus kind of knowing what happens in later volumes, because the thing that this volume does as its kind of its cliffhanger and its climax is basically the thing that Rinko gets ragged on for doing in her writing, like actually within the volume, because, you know, she writes all these stories about kind of like, you know, 30 something kind of middle-aged women who somehow, you know, they end up kind of with this handsome younger man, and like everybody's like, this is totally unrealistic, and then that kind of becomes like the pillar of the end of that first volume, and it's like, I think looking at that in isolation it could feel a bit like you're kind of having your cake and eating it with this one, but very much like having read at least a couple of volumes beyond this, it's like, you know what, all of that pays off like more than enough dividends to let them have that like that one indulgence.
Yeah, I feel like that works as well, especially when it all kind of spirals. I mean, I've read the entire series, and even especially towards the end, it starts to really like almost over backfill that. And it's like, yeah, I'm bought in. Don't worry. You don't need to give me more reasons to explain this stuff. If anything, I feel like the series could have ended a little earlier than it does, because it ends up padding itself out with the like Terra Rebar bits, which are like weird agony aunt panels. The author's note is also very funny, where Akiko Higashimura basically says, hey, I'm not going through this. I've just gotten married for a second time. And like, this is basically a comic like lampooning, but also digging into all my female friends who keep coming up to me and going, oh, I need to get married. So yeah, it's got that touch of the real about it, even though it does feel a bit mean at times. So it's like, you're just ragging on your friends. Like, what is this?
Yeah. I mean, one of the other things that I do really like about this volume is actually something that I brought up with Our Dreams at Dusk on the last show, in that this is another series that is really good at conveying emotion through illustration.
Oh, totally.
Like,
yeah.
There's one incredible kind of two-page spread where it's like, as we mentioned, like, you know, Rinko goes out for what she thinks is a date with this guy, like, sure that, like, okay, well, like, I blew him off before, but, like, this time he's going to come back and propose to me again, and it's all going to be great. And then, of course, like, you know, that all goes horribly wrong, because he's actually just like looking for advice to ask her assistant out, and there's this fantastic two-page spread of just like this kind of crack of lightning that just kind of shatters the entire building, and it's this fantastic two-page spread that is just, you know, it would be so easy to go the lazy route of, you know, oh, here's a picture of her heart breaking in two, but instead it just goes for this really spectacular kind of vista that plays off against this fantastic scenic backdrop that this whole scene has taken place on, which she's basically engineered to be as romantic as possible.
Yeah, she's got her BAPS on full display, which kind of helps.
yeah, like she's gone all in on like, yeah, this is it. Like, this is going to be my kind of fantastic, you know, high point of my life kind of thing. And just literally kind of the entire building just gets, you know, blown to smithereens. And there's another fantastic one kind of later in the volume where, you know, again, something just kind of comes and kind of, you know, just destroys everything that she's building up to, and just the floor just kind of just smashes underneath her and she just falls through it. And they're just these really good, just kind of like really simple, like, hey, this is just a very good visual representation of how that moment feels.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I feel like in the case of the lightning strike in the building, I don't even think it's a heartbreaking. I think it's just her ego shattering, because it wasn't like she was in love. It's just, you know, it's ego being destroyed, which is perhaps worse. Also, on the other end of the artistic sort of scale, I like there's a lot of very good faces and expressions drawn in little snatches of panel, or in tiny little small panels, or just to the sides of panels. Usually when the characters are raving drunk and have turned into this like screeching, scratchy mess where they're just like it's almost, I know this is a bit of a mean phrase, but it's almost harpy-esque, where they're just like, brah, you know, in the corner, like sometimes with their mouth full of food that they're stuffing. And, you know, just when they're acting up or acting badly, it's really fun to just see them kind of lose control and turn into crazed harridans almost.
And I do really like all of those kind of drinking scenes in general, like, because it would be so easy to make those scenes, both in terms of kind of like imagery and the use of text, it would be so easy to make them kind of overly busy or confusing, or to go down the opposite route and kind of keep them too simple and be kind of too focused on, like, well, here are the important things these characters are saying. But they're really good at being reflective of that kind of, like, you know, relatively busy bar where everybody who is, you're kind of focusing on has had a few drinks and they're kind of talking at a mile a minute. And it's just, it's pitch perfect in terms of just having that kind of busy, like, you know, everybody's talking, but you're still able to kind of keep a grasp on the conversation and what everybody's saying and how it's all going. And that also juxtaposes well with kind of some of the more quiet, kind of reflective moments that the series has, where it's just a character on their own, just kind of thinking about their latest screw up or whatever it decides to kind of focus on.
Yeah.
And it seems like it's equally at home kind of doing those really busy bustling scenes and then also doing the kind of the quiet kind of like I'm just kind of sat on my bed at the end of the day thinking about, you know, what has just happened in the day just gone.
Yeah, there's that one sort of like end of a chapter where it's basically like quiet TV dinner time where it's like I heated this up in the microwave, I do not care, it could taste like nothing, but I'm just going to sit here and rather sullenly eat this in my little flat. And it's kind of like, yeah, that's basically kind of real. That's basically it. Like, you got it. that's how it is at times. Sometimes you're going to eat half a pizza and not care about tossing the other half out because you just don't want to do a thing. So, yeah.
I think it's just like, it's, you know, quite often I think we kind of have praise for a series just because, you know, it's not just a bunch of teenage characters, you know, it's always nice to see older characters in a series, but like I feel like this series also just kind of really carries and makes good use of that rather than just being like, oh, these characters are older for the sake of it. Like, you know, the way everything plays out is really kind of intrinsic to kind of the age and the lived experience of those characters, and it's just very enjoyable to kind of see how that plays out and to be able to relate to it, at least some of it, as another 30-something.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I read this 2 years ago, and it's only gotten, you know, having read the entire balance of it and finding it really, like, kind of crushingly relatable in some ways, and not in others, which was also interesting because it was almost like a what-if story in some ways. But then also reading it again now is like, oh, okay, I'm a little bit older, I'm not that much wiser, but this all kind of has a different angle now, and I can see different ways this relates. And also, it's just fun to revisit the characters, even if I kind of know what's going to happen, but it's fun to watch the characters kind of stumble through things anew. So yeah, it's a very good read. Greatly enjoy it.
I'd be interested to hear what kind of people who are not in the 30 somethings bracket kind of like feel about it, if anybody who is younger than that has read this volume and you know has their own opinions on it, because you know I'm curious as to how it plays out if you've maybe not kind of had the same experiences, because you know it's really hard to look outside of that kind of bubble, if you like, in terms of, you know, how it would read if you're, you know, still a teenager or in your early 20s and you've maybe not quite reached that reach the kind of points that these characters have, because I feel like it is very much a kind of a story of its age bracket.
Yeah.
Both
in terms of the age bracket, but also in what they've grown up with. Like, there's one part where Rinko is basically like texting on her smartphone, but she hasn't learned the new format of swiping to write, and so she's tapping away individually, typing out letters, like, you know, a la an old phone. And I looked at that and went, yeah, I get that sometimes. Like, I look at people who just wave their finger around on the phone and they send an entire message and I go, what the fuck? So yeah, if we've got any younger millennials or zoomers in the audience, if you're the sort of person who watches and understands TikTok, because I fucking don't, please get in touch and let us know what you think of Tokyo Terror Eba Girls.
Please send us a message on our Snapchat. Oh wait, we don't have a Snapchat because we're too old for that.
No one has Snapchat anymore. It sunk itself. You know, it went bullshit. I don't know. Fuck it. I don't know. Send us a fucking, I don't know. Just what the fuck is TikTok, all right? What the fuck? Help. So yeah, that's Tokyo Terror Eba Girls. Apologies for going all over the shop, but it comes from a place of love and also mild wounding. I think, well, actually, last thing. Sorry, Andy. But The thing I enjoy about the characters, especially given their age, is that they have battle damage, but it's not like their fucking entire clan got wiped out. It's more the fact of like, oh, I had a shitty romance, and sometimes they have to write dumb shit for work, and I hate it, and it looks bad and reflects badly on me, but that's only me who thinks that, because everyone else thinks I'm just getting my job done, and so that sort of battle damage and personal sort of like tension is relatable strongly in a case of like, well, I've pushed myself into these situations and this is my lot now, and I'm old enough to know that I have to deal with it and can also move past it to some degree, but at the same time I'm still a prisoner of it because my brain will not let me forget about it. Oh fuck.
I mean, again, I think it's one of those things that other series would kind of obsessively focus on that as kind of like as part of their character of like, oh well, this past relationship, you know, has done all of this to me, or you know, my working life has, you know, these are the effects it's had, whereas yeah, like you say, it's very much like, you know, these characters have been shaped by their previous experiences, and you know, they are damaged to some extent by them, but like those past experiences aren't entirely what defined them. And like, again, I think that all helps to make them feel like well-rounded and kind of real characters, rather than just like, oh, this one event happened and that is like everything that I am is all based around that one experience.
Well, using the battle damage concept, I don't know about you, but like there are some events that I look back on in my life, and they could, depending on my state of mind, but also the situation I'm in, I can look back on it and go, well, I survived that and I got better for it. And sometimes I look back at the same event and go, fuck, why did I do that? Oh my God. Like, you know, you can take it both ways. Like the bad event can also be a good event, but the good event can also be slightly annoying. It's weird. Humans are complex and stupid.
Yeah. Well, that's just it. And kind of like any emotional experiences in particular, like they tend to, they're never a clear cut black or white. This was a good thing. This was a bad thing. Like there's usually, you know, some kind of, you know, shade of gray to it. And again, yeah, I think that's the kind of thing that this kind of series manages to put across somewhat.
Yeah. I think it, like, especially reading the author's note at the end, sorry, I mentioned this again, but like really helps put across like, the author Akiko Higashimura's like view and place on the comic and how she brings her own angle to it, because like, you know, she's had a marriage that went south, she remarried, she was a single mother for a good amount of time, and like has enough shit to deal with, and puts out some damn good comics, so there you are. Cool, so apologies for going along on that, but Andy, do you want to take away our second pick of the episode?
Yes, indeed. Having mentioned kind of that said failed marriage of Ake Higashimura, Blank Canvas, My So-Called Artist's Journey. The first volume starts with her introducing herself as a divorced woman with who's a single mother, who also writes manga, because unlike Tokyo Taraiba Girls, which is very much kind of based on reality but not completely, you know, autobiographical or biographical on anybody else's account, this is very much her own story of kind of how she became a manga artist, starting from pretty much the very beginning. So it kind of introduces her effectively as a high school student who, you know, lives in a small town. She's kind of a bit of an airhead, really. Like, her head is in the clouds. She reads a lot of shoujo manga. And basically, she's kind of carved out a career path for herself just completely in her head of like, oh, I'm just going to make shoujo manga. I'm going to make something really popular that's going to end up, you know, with like a live action adaptation. I'm probably going to marry the star of the live action adaptation because that's how that kind of stuff works. And then, you know, I'm going to have a great life of kind of wealth and relaxation. And, you know, I'll keep writing manga and drawing manga when I feel like it, because, you know, that would be cool. And that's going to be my life and it's going to be great. And ironically, because she kind of lives in kind of like a small town in Japan, and because she's kind of like outgoing and confident, everybody around her basically just says like, yeah, that sounds, you can do whatever you like, you know, you'll achieve your dreams. And it's, you know, it's kind of that sort of typical, like everybody is incredibly kind to her and is just like, yep, you know, you can do it. We believe in you. It'll be great. And so she kind of just kind of floats through life and her high school life, just kind of assuming that this is going to be the way things pan out. And eventually she kind of decides like, well, you know, I'm going to apply to go to an art school once I go to higher education. And she gets told by a friend of hers, like, oh, like I'm taking lessons with this art teacher who you know, he's really good. Like, he's a really good teacher. Like, you know, it might not be quite your thing, but, you know, you should probably go check him out, because, you know, if you really want to get into art school, like, you know, it would be worth you getting some professional.
I feel like said
tuition.
Friend is a bit more rough than that, but yeah. Totally.
And well, yeah, there's a little bit more to that. But yeah, so she goes and to visit this art teacher again, like, ego big as a house, thinking she's going to get there, show this teacher her drawings, and he's just going to say, oh my god, you're amazing, you're a savant, you're a genius, you don't need my help, in fact, can you teach me to draw some stuff, because, you know, that's how good you are. The reality is rather different. Like, this art teacher is somewhat gruff, to put it mildly, and kind of rough and ready teacher, who basically calls her out on her bullshit, and is just like, no, all of this is terrible, like, you know, you can't draw. And effectively just kind of, he runs a tight ship, it would be fair to say, in that, you know, he doesn't take any nonsense from anybody. He will call anybody who goes to his art school out for every single tiny mistake. He wanders around with a bamboo sword and smacks people if they're not drawing right, or if they're not drawing quickly enough. And, you know, he's a kind of a ferocious teacher who, needless to say, Akiko is kind of really not into, but kind of puts up with it. And the rest of the volume is really a lot about kind of her education from this teacher as she goes all the way through to entrance exams. There are some really fantastic kind of little stories and anecdotes about her time kind of around then, because even as she improves at her art, like, her grades and everything else are terrible, and so she kind of figures out a ridiculous method, effectively, of, like, passing the standard kind of, you know, academic parts of any entrance exams. And it kind of turns into this actually quite kind of heartwarming story, in a sense of kind of actually, for all of his kind of, like, gruff exterior, that kind of this teacher is actually kind of, you know, cares for all of his students a lot, and actually does a lot to kind of get her to the place that she needs to be, before leaving things on a cliffhanger that, as kind of entrance exams kind of start to come to a close, which definitely leaves me wanting to read more of this. There are 5 volumes in total. Only the first is out in English thus far, but I do really need to see where this goes next. And yeah, like, it's really enjoyable. Like, it's a very entertaining volume. I mean, the crazy kind of personal angle of it to me is that I had a GCSE art teacher who could be like the Brummy lost twin brother of this art teacher, because Mr. Mauser was my GCSE art teacher, and he didn't have a bamboo sword, but he had a big wooden window pole that he would happily hit people with if they weren't working fast enough or well enough. He also had a bunch of other kind of tricks up his sleeve to bully people into doing what they were supposed to be doing, including, like, putting everybody's stools up on the desks so that if they were messing around, then he'd just pull the stool off the desk and you'd have to hope that you didn't go with it. And, like, he was very much cut from a similar cloth of being, like, absolutely brutal. Like, he would tell you, if your work was crap, he would tell you in very literal terms. And, like, I was definitely getting some flashbacks, like, reading parts of this volume, of just like, oh god, like, I've kind of lived through at least part of this experience. And, like, I don't know if I remember it as fondly as the author here does, and it maybe didn't end as well in terms of my art career as it did for Akiko Higashimura. But there was definitely a very personal level of, like, yeah, there are teachers like this out there. Like, some people might be reading this thinking this is a bit far-fetched, but I'm just like, oh yeah, this totally happens.
Yeah, no, I had a teacher who, an art teacher who, if you were just in one of his classes, he kind of didn't give a living shit, and he came across as a very sort of like, why am I here type teacher. But if you went to any of his after school clubs, then holy shit, like, you had to justify every minute you were there. And I went to none of them because fuck that. But yeah, I must admit, I kind of enjoyed this series, but at the same time, there's some weird pacing stuff with it that, I must admit, I thought this was going to be a one shot for some godforsaken reason. I didn't know it was 5 volumes going in. I thought it was going to be like 2 most. And then when this ended on its cliffhanger, I felt a bit irritated because the pace had been slowing down. I mean, admittedly, more stuff had been happening. There was more texture and more interesting events to cover. But the series suffers a great deal, to my mind at least, from it being a chapter-based series where it constantly has to kind of ramp up and wrap up at the end of chapters, which eats into the time, especially as it goes on and you learn more about Sensei and how he interacts with Akiko and the rest of the cast, Futami, the like cool black-haired perm other character who is damn smart and also is whip smart, but also wants to get into art school, but wants to go to the city. And so it's kind of laser focus on that and is way more determined and way more realistic about her choices. She's the one who kind of kicks Akiko into touch and says, hey, go to this art school, idiot. And, you know, the back and forth of, you know, the teacher and Akiko as it kind of grows this sort of relationship, because, you know, the teacher, as you can tell from the character, from the characters kind of pining after him in like a, you know, mentor style way, like is very pivotal to her getting anywhere and actually doing anything. Like he will not put up with procrastination or dilly-dallying, as it were. But that's the thing that kind of gets me about this series, is that at the end of chapters, it will do a good several pages of like wistful, open-ended, oh, Sensei, why didn't I tell you this at the time, Sensei? Oh, Sensei. And it's like, yeah, this is kind of cool. Like, I get it. But at the same time, this is wasting time and is dragging the series out, where the constant sort of ramp up and ramp down in between chapters is wearing me out. And then I got to the end of the volume and I was like, oh, five volumes? Shit, that's a lot. Maybe I'm not in for the full run of this. Just because it feels like, I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm sure there's, if this is the first volume and this is like the more introductory sensible stuff, then I'm very interested to read the rest of it, but you know, it just felt padded out in some cases, and part of that is just like because it's being brutally honest and the main character just keeps eating shit because like, you know, pride and ego, and also just a willingness to give up, like the motto of give up before you begin, like giving up is a new beginning sort of idea, which is, you know, lame, but also useful for your own mental health in some ways. Like there's this whole sort of hanging question of, hey, you know, now you've put your mind to it, you're probably quite good, but I'm not going to tell you that because that would immediately implode your ego and make you completely lose out on doing anything worthwhile, which is an interesting sort of undercurrent of this series. But yeah, the pacing of it just kind of wore me out. And at this point now, having finished the first volume, I enjoyed it, but kind of don't think I'm going to bother with the rest. But yeah, maybe that's just me.
Yeah, I mean, I was certainly surprised to see it was five volumes. I kind of assumed it would maybe be a couple. And I assume it carries on kind of well beyond kind of like high school and kind of higher education.
It's an artist's journey. Like it's clearly going up to like, I mean, manga artists always go through a crazy career path anyway. No two are the same, but I can imagine this going through quite a few different stages to, you know, getting to the point where you're writing Princess Jellyfish, a well-beloved and much adapted manga.
Yeah. And I mean, I think I kind of agree with you on the pacing thing. Like, I think it does kind of struggle from having to have chapters in it, and it's kind of like one of those unfortunate kind of problems of the medium that I guess it has to have that cadence, and it does feel like it has to kind of shoehorn that in to what would otherwise just be kind of a singular through line. I don't know whether any of these kind of like, you know, little non sequiturs at the end will kind of pay off in future volumes. I was kind of all but waiting for kind of the afterward and saying, yeah, and then my teacher passed away, which is why all this stuff is in here, but it kind of never actually follows through on that in any real sense. But yeah, I don't know, like I just enjoyed it as much as anything, just from kind of the purely autobiographical sense of you know, seeing this creator's career panning out. And you know, I think it's so easy to kind of look at artists and kind of, you know, manga artists and authors as kind of the fully formed finished product, and kind of like any kind of creator, you kind of see their works in their final form and you just kind of think like, oh yeah, well they were always this good and always this smart. And sometimes it's nice just to have a reminder of like, actually no, that's, you know, there's a lot of hard work that's gone into reaching this point. And I also just find aspects of kind of, you know, her life as she describes it quite interesting, because I feel like especially kind of stories about, you know, small towns, whether it's in, you know, Japan or England or the USA or whatever, they tend to usually either go down the lines of like, oh yeah, like it was really boring because, you know, I was a teenager and I wanted to live in the big city, but I was just ended up in this small town. Or it goes the other way of it's just like, no, everybody was so nice and supportive and it was great. And this series is interesting because of the way it kind of splits the difference there of just like, oh no, everyone was really nice to me, but that was also the biggest problem because there was nobody around to just actually be realistic and kind of, you know, set expectations in terms of saying, no, like, you know, this isn't going to work out as things are currently. Like, everybody was happy just to kind of let you drift by, like, you know, off of your own assumptions rather than actually telling you what you needed to hear.
Oh, totally.
And that I feel is like kind of an angle that you don't often hear. Like, it's usually one extreme or the other of like, oh, it was great or it was terrible, and not like, well, you know, it was good, but also here is the counterpoint to that, the kind of the gut punch that sort of underlies the whole thing.
Yeah, this is gonna, I mean, it's very much a case of big fish in a small pond syndrome, whereas in this case it's moderately half decent fish in a very small puddle, and like living out in the sticks, like she's got to take a bus and it takes like an hour plus to get to her teachers, and the bus is hourly sort of thing. There's no real way I can explain this without sounding like a big head, but I'll make sure it's earnest. But so I had a similar sort of thing of thinking throughout, like, my entire youth, I was hot shit. I was, like, you know, put in special classes, yada yada. Teachers had great expectations for me. I talked a lot of shit about how I was going to take over the world, blah, 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 blah. Got to GCSEs and kind of just looked at the exams and went, ah, fuck it, I don't have to try. And then kind of did fine, like, got into sixth form, etc., like, did fine there. But it was a case of, like, ah, whatever, I'm bored. And then same thing with sixth form, where it's like, ah, like, I know this shit and I don't have to try that hard to just do all right, so fuck it. And then before I knew it, it's like I went to university and I'm like, oh fuck, I'm just some podunk idiot here, shit. Like, it was very much a case of like, oh, I'm not king shit of the mountain, I was just one vaguely smart dude in an underfunded school, shit. And now I'm living back in the same town again and going, yeah, this place needs a lot of love, like, what the fuck. So
yeah,
I'm really not trying to sound big-headed. It's a case of, man, I fucking got high on my own supply so much that it took me 2+ years to fucking undo that damage and learn that, yo, you're not king shit of the mountain, but you're also not insignificant. You're still a human being. Maybe find a middle ground. Oh crap, it's going to take you until you're like 28 to figure that out.
Yeah, and I suspect that is probably a surprisingly kind of common kind of, you know, experience as a kid. I mean, I certainly had a very similar thing where, you know, I was kind of like, you know, one of the top students when I was at middle school, and then I got selected for a grammar school, and suddenly like, oh, you know, you're basically in the top X percent of people, and you're kind of average within that top 8%. And that's a real culture shock when you've always been kind of like, oh, this person is top of the class. It's suddenly like, nah, actually, you know, you're kind of average in the grand scheme of things. And, you know, that can be quite a blow to a young person's ego. And, I very much had a similar thing of, you know, just going through that cadence and at some point being like, I just don't really care anymore. And, it's all very informative stuff, in terms of kind of like, you know, how your life pans out for you. And yeah, I think it's interesting to kind of see that, you know, sort of writ large within this particular volume as well. Cause I think there is a certain similarity to that as well.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. But also, you know, you can see the character, like, in main characters, like horizons broadening, but as well as focusing at times on, okay, so you know I'm going to different parts of the country and I'm having to, like, this is before mobile phones, so I had to like take a flight and then a train and just had to hope that everything kind of all meshed. And, you know, I only found out stuff through a letter and then someone blabbed about what the contents of the letter was. So it kind of has all these very, you know, very human touches of, like, you know, the stink of the real of, like, no, this is how it actually happened because it's mundane, it's real life, like, it's not surprising, like, things don't just magically happen. So yeah, it's I enjoyed it, but at the same time it's one of these things where I look at it and go, man, I'm sure I don't really think I'm in for five, I'm in for it, but I'm not in for five volumes of it, if that makes sense.
I think that makes sense. And I mean, again, kind of in terms of the art style, like, it certainly, it's not as kind of as expressive or as kind of interesting as Tokyo Taraiba Girls in that sense, which, you know, is partly perhaps if this work did come first, that is probably partly down to, you know, the just kind of the experience, but also I guess because it's not fictional, like it doesn't have as much of an opportunity to kind of play with things from a kind of a visual level. Like it's pretty workmanlike is probably not really a fair thing to throw at it, because I think it looks pretty good for the most part, but like it's not, it's very infrequently is it kind of like eye-catching in any particularly interesting way. Like it kind of it does what it needs to, but it never was kind of like, oh, this is really cool.
Definitely. I think it's very sort of like, you know, it's structured and also very past tense. Obviously it is because the character's looking back on their own life, but it kind of falls in. I feel like it both falls into this wistful sort of lens, but also you're not completely into the time of the that's being recounted. So there is a certain amount of distance, but it kind of oscillates there. I'm not doing a very good job of explaining that, but it is a fact where it's like, oh, you know that it is both a story of the past, but also a story that's being looked back on. So there's like a very mild tension between those two about which, you know, which headspace you're in. Although most of it is like, holy shit, I was an idiot. Which, admittedly, looking at some of the dumb shit that this character, that the main author did in their youth, holy shit, you did a lot of dumb shit. I'm shocked you got anywhere. Like, goddamn. Thank goodness. Thank God for that teacher.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there are some moments, especially around the entrance exams, that is reminds me somewhat of Giant Bomb's Dan Riker. Sometimes, you know, there are certain people who just like somehow manage to luck into things that they kind of have no right to, and there's certainly a feeling of that in terms of like some of the stuff you see in here, where it's sort of like, yeah, how did this even work out in your favor? Which admittedly also kind of plays into one of the best, definitely the best joke of this volume, where it's like, you know, she basically finds a guide for kind of not quite but almost cheating on exams, and just again, like, ego as big as her head, just blasé, like, shows it to this art teacher, whereas everybody else is in shock of like, don't show him, like, he's gonna like lose his nut, to which he's just like, this is amazing, like I'm gonna tell all my bad students to buy this, because like, this is great, this is how everyone should pass their exams.
I mean it makes sense, because he's totally dedicated to like making sure his students do well. Like he's not high on ideals. He is very much a case of like, hey, you come to me for tutorial, I'm going to help you in whatever way I can. Like, it's part of why he screams get 90% at her, which comes from a place of love, kind of. So, I mean, I think it totally makes sense. Also, like, frankly, when I was doing GCSEs and also A-levels, that was half the shit we learned was, hey, I know we taught you this sort of subject several years ago, but we're going to relearn it now because you're now having to learn to a different curriculum and set of questions they're going to ask you. And it's like, what the fuck? And, you know, that's a damnation of the health of, I suppose, the educational system in some ways. Let's not go into that too much. But it was definitely a case of, hey, this is the sort of shit you're going to need to do to pass those exams, because if not, you're going to be all at fucking sea and wondering, you know, where your time went. So you need to learn this shit, this shit, this shit, and this is what you need to consider. Like, it was almost like a fucking empathy course in learning how to fucking, like, dissect an invigilator's brain. To a mild yes. degree, but it was also, like, I mean, to be fair, that was also, like, why when I went to got to degree level, it was quite refreshing, because one part of my degree, at least, was a fucking anything goes exam. But the last exam we had to take was just, there are 12 long form questions. They can be on anything from the syllabus, and we don't care about you getting 12 answers. There's only 100 points out of 120 available. You just have to work through it and show you're working and show that you know what the fuck you're talking about. And that shit was great. That was my best exam, unsurprisingly, because I could both bullshit, but also just pluck shit out of my head and put it down and try and work through it. And it was kind of refreshing, but also if you try to do an entire course like that, you would go mental.
And it's also one of the big kind of like shocks / refreshing things when you get into like the world of work, because where I was like, oh, this is just like, this is completely different from all the nonsense that I've been having to do in education. Like, this is a completely different world, and for the better, like, compared to the kind of rote learning that you have to put up with up to that point.
Yeah, I mean, I still remember some of the best parts of my, I mean, I came to blows with a teacher almost about disagreements on stuff, but history teacher was great, because we would burn through the boring material and then get to the end and then do a fun thing about around it, where it's like, I'm going to make you guys watch a Vietnam war film. I found one that's probably going to scar you a bit. And it's like, what? And then we watched Platoon. And it's like, what the fuck? Why are we, what? Like, yeah, that shit was wild. Probably not a good idea. But yeah, then again, I spent most of my youth trying to watch films that you weren't supposed to.
Yeah, didn't we all?
Yeah, I mean, who the fuck hasn't watched Terminator 11? but anyway, I'm digressing like a big deal. But yeah, I'm saying this a lot, but I enjoyed this, but not enough to continue it. Maybe, Andy, if you'd like to continue, I can then guinea pig off of you.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'll definitely at least be reading the second volume. I'm kind of curious to see where that ends and kind of, you know, where it goes from there. But yeah, I don't know. Like, I'm a sucker for kind of autobiographical stuff. Like, I like hearing about other people's lives and you know, how they came to end up in the position that they're in. So, you know, I'm kind of the natural target market for that, and so much more so when it's, you know, somebody whose works I've read and have kind of like admired in the past. I mean, it's certainly it's not as kind of like, you know, hard hitting or eye opening as something like Mario Carter's autobiography, like, you know, that's for sure. But yeah, I know. I feel like if you're a big fan of, you know, Princess Jellyfish, Tokyo Tarot Girls, etc., and you kind of want to learn more about the person that created those, this is probably gonna do exactly what you want it to, if nothing else.
Yeah, I feel if nothing else, it really kind of like having the author like bear themselves to this degree is interesting, just from like, you know, them having a lot of stuff to work through from their past to then put on the page. Like, you know, it's clear that a lot of stuff happened. You know, as mentioned, she had a failed relationship. She was a single mother for a while who was still drawing manga, which sounds like the workload from hell, frankly. Like, fuck that. Jesus. but yeah, it's kind of, you know, it's kind of the sort of thing that makes Tokyo Terror Reba Girls is like just the whiff of the real. But at the same time, like knowing when to make it an interesting manga on its own ends. As a quick note / not plug, but this is kind of a poisoned chalice of a recommendation, but if you like autobiographies, may I recommend A Drifting Life by Yoshihiro Tatsumi. I think it was physical only in a single big honking volume, which is probably half a kilogram or more, but is fascinating both as a history of manga itself and the publishing thereof in the post-war world, and also just in getting really into, like, really into the character's mind space, equally about how they were a fuck up. But yeah, if you can find a copy of that, I recommend it highly. I haven't yet assigned it as reading for this podcast, because finding it can be a bit of a pain, so I didn't want to lump that on you, frankly.
Yeah, and it's definitely one that I've heard kind of mentioned in hushed tones many times before, so yeah, that sounds like a sound recommendation.
Yeah, Yoshihiro Tatsumi in general, very good. Expensive as fuck, because, like, the prestige comic publishers got a hold of him, not manga publishers, so most of the releases are not digital, and they're expensive, and sometimes hardback, because what the fuck? But yeah, so that's Blank Canvas Edition. Anything else to mention, Andy?
No, I think that's everything on
cool,
that one.
Cool, man. So, getting into close down, we've kind of gone long on this episode. All killer, no filler. First and foremost, though, what we can talk about next time. So, we've got another theme going on here, because we're idiots. I have changed at last minute to recommend we read the first volume of the Neon Genesis Evangelion manga. In particular, the 3-in-1 omnibus version, or just read the first three volumes. Mostly because the first volume is a bit thin, and I think, you know, the series lends itself well to the omnibus format, where there's now like 5 discrete books rather than 15 of the damn things, or 14, I think. And Andy, how about you?
Again, continuing with that theme of the current hot show that everybody's talking about. I've never gotten around to reading Moika Anno's Insufficient Direction, which of course is very heavily based around her husband Hideaki Anno. So I figured I should fix that. So Insufficient Direction is my pick, which apparently is available on Crunchyroll Manga, because I forgot Crunchyroll Manga existed and bought a physical copy.
Idiot. No, I read it previously on Crunchyroll Manga, but that hasn't been for at least a year, so I'm not sure if it's still up there. I may have to buy a physical edition myself.
It is still on there, because I did check that after you mentioned it to me, but I thought I'd go old school on this one and read it on an actual book.
What's less painful, buying a physical book or having to enable Flash every single fucking time? Oh god. Anyway, so close down again. Thank you everyone for listening. You can find more of our podcasts in your podcatcher feed of choice. Our website is screentone.club. On there, you can find a list of our previous episodes and the titles we've covered, which I swear to God, I'm trying to keep up to date. If you like the podcast, please consider telling a friend. It really, really helps get the word out there. Thank you to everyone who is joining to our Twitter feed, following even our Twitter feed at Screen Tone Club. We've got some really interesting sort of stuff, people joining that. Feel free to drop us a line on Twitter if you want to. You can also email us at show@screentone.club. If you also fancy, please consider, I know I'm hammering it, but please consider joining up to the Patreon. We're getting to the point where we're starting to get somewhat close to our next goal for the podcast, which involves 2 bonus episodes a month, which means you'll get twice as much bonus content. Woohoo! And that'll mean my voice will get destroyed even more than before it is currently. Woof. So, last thing to note, personal plugs. My name is Elliot Page. You can find me at Elliot Page on Twitter, again, endeavouring to post pictures of my cats, although at the moment they're not being very photogenic and they're fighting each other because I guess they're teenagers now, idiots. And Andy, how about you?
Yes, you can find me guaranteed not to talk about Evangelion, probably, at Hannah's 1979.
Cool. So thank you very much, everyone. And this has been your episode of Screen Tone Club. And from me, good night.
Bye, everyone.